Welcome back, Hemingway listeners, to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things together. Talking about part 8, chapter 8, Levin is a suicidal. Did we know this already? TA131901 said, "Oh, Levin, I can't even. I'm not the biggest fan of Levin, but this is where Tolstoy started to lose me. It's like the very end of War and Peace. Ah." Geez, I don't know. It's not quite as bad as the very end of War and Peace. That second epilogue. Like, that's just straight rambling without even the characters. But no, I get what you mean. Like, the end of the book, he always goes a bit haywire. I don't know. Maybe it's not Levin, it's me. I'm an indifferent atheist who's never been interested in not being an atheist, so it's very possible that I'm just not intellectually capable of understanding his crisis. Indifferent atheist, that's a good way to say it. I always have just said agnostic, because atheist always, when you say atheist, people assume that you care. So I like you saying indifferent atheist. Like, I'm an atheist and I don't give a shit. Like, I don't want to talk about religion. The whole conversation, whether you're an atheist talking about how much religion or God isn't real, or you're a religious person, the whole conversation to me is just like, shut up, I don't care. Talk about anything, literally anything else. So I've always said agnostic, because then people don't tend to like debate, and like it kind of somehow stops the conversation. And like, yeah, I don't know if there's a God or not. I don't think there is, and I don't really give a shit. And that's yeah, so I don't know. Thank you for saying that, TA131901. We are kindred in that way. And I'm sorry to anyone else who that offends. Correlate said, "I didn't catch what that he was suicidal. Looking back, do you mean without a solution to which he felt he could not live? Or was there something more? I thought his plan was more to spend every waking minute agonizing over the solution rather than suicide, but maybe I'm not taking the line literally enough. I'll admit I'm kind of disappointed to see Levin turning toward religion in the very end. I liked him as an atheist. Of course, as an atheist myself, I'm a bit biased." Yeah, I said he was asuicidal, not that he was suicidal. Those are slightly different things. Asuicidal is someone who is aware. It kind of has, like, doesn't want to die, doesn't want to commit suicide, but also romanticizes it. And feels like they understand why people do it. Like, they wish that it would fix things, but they know it won't, so they don't do it. Something like that. I don't know. So, like, him making active measures, not having those cords around and the various things that he might... The gun, I think he says. He doesn't have his gun around or the cords because he's worried he might kill himself, shoot himself, or hang himself. He's not suicidal, like, he doesn't want to die, but it is in his head as something that he might do. Swim said the mum fishy. Oh, Swim, this is a long ass comment. And, it's quite late. I don't know if I'm going to read it all. I'll read the first bit until you get to the excerpt. Swim said the mum fishy. He said, "No, this is new. With Levin, it's always something, though. I swear he is more emotional and moody as a grown man than any random adolescent drama llama around. I find him exhausting. Out of the three Shabatsky sisters, Natalie, the one married to Lvov, the diplomat, seems to be the only one who married an emotionally stable guy. Dolly has Steva, the philanderer and profligate. Kitty has Levin, the hypercritical, despairing existentialist who is now suicidal. It's often assumed that Levin and Kitty are the happy family that Tolstoy is referencing. They may become one, but they aren't there yet. And considering Levin's temperament, I have my doubts. If they were, we wouldn't be getting pages and pages of Sturm and Strife. I submit it is Lvovs who are the happy family, and who are only briefly mentioned. There's another great article that I won't post because spoilers that makes this case." And there's an excerpt from that great article, which I will not read. Sluggy with 3 G's. Isaiah Berlin wrote an essay called The Hedgehog and the Fox that I think really shines a light on what is happening in this chapter. In it, he quotes a Greek proverb, "The fox knows many things, the hedgehog knows but one." His point is that the fox explores all aspects of the field and his defences run all around the countryside, while the hedgehog has only one central defence. Berlin divides all writers into hedgehogs and foxes. He calls Shakespeare the greatest fox and Dante and Dostoevsky the greatest hedgehogs. Tolstoy, however, is born to be a fox, but would like to make himself into a hedgehog, says Berlin. You can see his characters, especially Levin, exploring everything like a fox throughout the book, but here at the end he thinks he has come across his one central idea that he can base everything else around. This is where Tolstoy saw himself at this time. And by giving his realization to Levin, he's trying to build that centralized philosophy into his work. I just can't stick with Tolstoy, though. He is born a fox, and you can see the definite shift in his works as he gets older and more disillusioned with his ideas. When I read this novel now, I don't see it as Levin reaching his ultimate philosophical end point. Many other times in the novel, Levin has arrived at an idea or philosophy that he felt was complete, only to become dissatisfied and continue searching. Like Tolstoy, Levin will forever be a fox, always searching out new ideas and experiences, and can never be content to settle into a single idea. Wow, very, very interesting. I love that sluggy with three G's. That metaphor, the foxes and the hedgehogs, really, really good. Which one is Tolstoy? Yeah, he just, it's like it's from his childhood or something, right? Like, he tries to be a fox, tries, and at the end of the day, he just flops back into this big comfy chair of hedgehogness. You know, that's where he puts his feet up. Still saying that, I do like Tolstoy a lot. And I like his book. Out of those lists, Shakespeare, Dante, Dosto, Tolstoy, I'd say Shakespeare and Tolstoy are my two favourite from that list. I'm a Norwegian, said, I listened to your reading walking home today. Well, thanks very much. I decided to pick up the book when writing my comments since I had already forgotten exactly what I wanted to say in response to the chapter. And I discovered that they are completely different. That's the Bartlett edition that I'm Norwegian is reading, and we're reading the Maud one. The themes are the same, but it's written completely differently. There's not even a mention of Kant or Schopenhauer or the theological stuff Levin had pored over. Well, that's crazy that they just completely change it. We didn't know that Levin was struggling at all. Kitty just in the last chapter commented how happy Levin had been since they moved out of the city, but we are finally getting into the parts I talked about many months ago, the lines about Levin hiding his shotgun and cords. They're lifted right out of Tolstoy's diary, word for word. Other paragraphs seem straight out of his A Confession. But as the beginning of the chapter mentions, Levin has been grumbling over the meaning of life for some time now. Levin mentions that the descriptive beliefs that had replaced his younger religious beliefs do not help you in life, and how could they? Descriptive beliefs simply tell you how the world works, but they cannot tell you anything about why we live, or for what purpose we continue our lives. And here's an extract from A Confession. It had come to this, that I, a healthy, fortunate man, felt I could no longer live. Some irresistible power impelled me to rid myself one way or another of life. I cannot say I wished to kill myself. The power which drew me away from life was stronger, fuller, and more widespread than any mere wish. It was a force similar to the former striving to live, the former striving to live, only in a contrary direction. All my strength drew me away from life. The thought of self-destruction now came to me as naturally as thoughts of how to improve my life had come formerly, and it was seductive that I had to be wily with myself lest I should carry it out too hastily. I did not wish to hurry, only because I wanted to use all efforts to disentangle the matter. If I cannot unravel matters, there will always be time. And it was then that I, a man favoured by fortune, hid a cord from myself, lest I should hang myself from the cross piece of the partition in my room, where I undressed alone every evening, and I ceased to go out shooting with a gun lest I should be tempted by so easy a way of ending my life. I did not myself know what I wanted. I feared life, desired to escape from it, yet still hoped something of it. There are so many paragraphs I want to share from a confession, but I think this one above describes the overall situation the best. In the chapter, Levin notices something that I still don't really understand, that people don't give these questions a second thought, that they contentedly just continue with their lives, busying themselves with other questions, never feeling even a tinge of the oppressive shadow of meaninglessness that the questions of meaning seem to just wash over them without a reaction. To me, that seems like accepting the order, now dig and fill this hole until you die, and just okie dokie. But that seems to be the default position nowadays. I think you just get tired, is all it is. Like I used to do my own head in, thinking all those things and wondering what's the point and trying to find the point and putting all this effort in and trying to be like stoic about it and trying to be this and that and always questioning and reading and all the rest and grappling with life and death and should I stay, should I go, all that crap. And eventually it's just like you just get tired of it and you're just like, you know what, this conversation has been running around in my head for 10 years. Day after day, just the same string of thoughts, like looping around, just the same thing. You know, I go in one end, come out the other, and you just at a certain point go, let's just not. Who gives a shit? You know, let's just do something else. And then you just start busying yourself with other things, you know? And, just do other stuff. Because you just kind of, it's not that you find any resolve or anything like that, and the questions still crop up in your head at different points when you're like heightened emotionally, but they peter out and you just kind of, who cares? And I think that's why my attitude towards, like, whenever they bring up religion or whenever they bring up this stuff, I'm just like, oh, I don't give a shit. Like, I've had this conversation in my head for a decade and I'm done with it. Like, it just gets you nowhere. Not necessarily about religion, but just like that kind of stuff. So, I don't know. What am I doing? Ranting. Never mind. Let's keep reading. Chapter 10 goes like this. When Levin thought about what he was and why he lived, he could find no answer and was driven to despair. But when he left off asking himself those questions, he seemed to know what he was and why he lived. For he acted and lived unfalteringly and definitely, recently even more unfalteringly than before. When he returned to the country in June, he went back to his ordinary occupations, husbandry, intercourse with the peasants and with his neighbours, management of his house and of his sisters' and brothers' affairs, which were entrusted to him, relations with his wife and relatives, cares about his baby and his new hobby, beekeeping, which he took up with enthusiasm that spring, occupied all his time. Jeez, talk about a self-insert. These matters interested him, not because he justified them to himself by any general theories, as he had done previously. On the contrary, being now on the one hand disenchanted by the ill success of his former occupations for the general welfare, on the other hand, too much occupied with his own thoughts and by the mass of affairs that overwhelmed him from all sides, he quite abandoned all the calculation of public utility, and these matters interested him only because it seemed to him that he had to do what he was doing and could not act otherwise. Formerly it had been so, almost from childhood, and increasingly so, till his complete maturity. When he tried to do anything for the good of everybody, for humanity, for Russia, for the whole village, he had noticed that the thoughts of it were agreeable, but the activity itself was always unsatisfactory. There was no full assurance that the work was really necessary, and the activity itself, which at first seemed so great, ever lessened and lessened till it vanished. But now, since his marriage, when he began to confine himself more and more to living for himself, though he no longer felt any joy at the thought of his activity, he felt confident that his work was necessary, saw that it progressed far better than formerly, and that it was always growing more and more. Now, as if involuntarily, he cut ever deeper and deeper into the earth, so that he, like a ploughshare, could not get out without turning the sod. For the family to live as their grandfathers and fathers had been accustomed to live, that is, at the same educational level, and so to bring up their children, was undoubtedly necessary. It was just as necessary as to dine when hungry, and therefore just as it was necessary to prepare dinner, so it was necessary to arrange the husbandry at Pokrovsk in such a way as to derive an income from it. As surely as one must pay one's debts, so surely was it necessary to keep the patrimony in such a state that when his son inherited it, he would thank his father as Levin thanked his grandfather for all that he had built and planted. To do this, he must not lease the land, but must farm it himself, keep cattle, manure the fields, and plant woods. It was as impossible not to look after his brothers' and sisters' affairs, and those of all the peasants who came for advice and were accustomed to do so, as it is impossible to abandon a baby you are already holding in your arms. It was necessary to look after the comforts of his sister-in-law and her children, who had been invited, and of his wife and child, and it was impossible not to pass at least a small portion of each day with them. All this, with game shooting and his new hobby of beekeeping, filled up the whole of that life which seemed to him, when he thought about it, to have no meaning. But besides knowing definitely what he had to do, Levin also knew how to do it all, and which affair was the more important of the two. He knew that he must hire labourers as cheaply as possible, but that he must not take them in bondage for less than they were worth by advancing them money, though this would be very profitable. He might sell straw to the peasants in a time of shortage, though he felt sorry for them, but an inn or a public house, although it brought in a revenue, must be done away with. Felling trees must be punished as severely as possible, but if peasants let their cattle stray, he must not exact fines from them. And though it grieved the watchman and weakened discipline, the strayed cattle must not be detained. He must lend money to Peter to liberate him from the usurers to whom he was paying 10% a month. But he must neither reduce nor postpone the payments of rent by the peasants who were in default. The steward must not be excused when the small meadow was not mown and the grass was wasted, but grass must not be mown on the 80 desiatinas which had been planted with young trees. He must not pardon a labourer who went home at a busy time because his father had died. Sorry as he might be for the man, part of his pay had to be deducted for the precious months during which he had been absent, but he could not neglect giving a monthly allowance to the old domestic serfs, who were of no use at all to him. Levin knew, too, that on returning home, the first thing he must do was to go to his wife, who was unwell, and that the peasant, who had been waiting for 3 hours to see him, could wait a little longer, and he knew that in spite of all the pleasures of hiving a swarm, he must forego that pleasure, let the old beekeeper hive the swarm without him, and go talk to the peasants who had found him at the apiary. Whether he was acting well or ill, he did not know, and far from laying down the law about it, he now avoided talking or thinking about it. Thinking about it led him into doubts and prevented him from seeing what he should and should not do, but when he did not think, but just lived, he unceasingly felt in his soul the presence of an infallible judge deciding which of two possible actions was the better and which the worse, and as soon as he did what he should not have done, he immediately felt this. In this way he lived, not knowing or seeing any possibility of knowing what he was or why he lived in the world, and he suffered so much from that ignorance that he was afraid he might commit suicide, while at the same time he was firmly cutting his own particular definite path through life. And that's the chapter. Wow, Levin. Keeping busy, eh? Have your say about that chapter over at the subreddit. Thanks very much for listening, and I'll see you tomorrow.